Hyperion to a Saturn.
Welcome to the 28th episode of Hyperion to a Satyr, the Fire and Water Podcast Network's Hamlet podcast. I'm your host, Siskoid, your guide on a scene-by-scene deep dive look at Shakespeare's masterwork through the lens of not only the text, but many film, television, comics, and music adaptations. Today, we start our coverage of Act 4 with its first three scenes. They all have the same motive purpose, sending Hamlet to England as reprisal for killing Polonius, or if you prefer, to prevent him from killing the king. I've chosen to take all three scenes as a whole since many adaptations skimp on one or two of them, and because they are in fact very brief. In scene 1, Claudius finds Gertrude distraught after her meeting with Hamlet. In scene 2, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern hunt down the prince. And in scene 3, Claudius confronts and exiles him. Before addressing the adaptations, let's examine the bard's text. So enter Claudius with Rosencrantz and Guildenstern to ask Gertrude where her son is. Quoth Gertrude, "Bestow this place on us a little while." So, as usual, Gertrude has no patience or trust for Claudius's lieutenants, RNG, no more so than the late Polonius. She's shooing them away with this line. This is consistent throughout the play, but subtle and easily missed or ignored because she never makes a speech about it, part of her underwritten character. Of Hamlet, she says, "Mad as the sea and wind, when both contend which is the mightier, in his lawless fit, behind the arras, hearing something stir, whips out a rapier, etc." So note the accumulation of seagoing imagery building up to Hamlet's departure from England. He's as mad as the sea and wind. And before that, Claudius speaks of heaves Gertrude as the swelling waves of the ocean, her sighs and tears poetically carrying Hamlet out of her life. In the play, water portends terrible things, whether it be any given character's tears, Hamlet's exile at sea, and remember how he feared the ghost would lead him off the cliff, or Ophelia's impending drowning, for that matter. After the description of Polonius's murder, Claudius says, "It had been so with us, had we been there." Now, obviously, Claudius thinks of himself first, and he's right, Hamlet was angling for him. In the lines that follow, he includes Gertrude and everyone at Elsinore, but he thought of himself first. Now, in the text, it's clear that Gertrude does not divulge what Hamlet has said to her, either about his father's murder or that he's only playing at madness. One thing to watch as we go through the various adaptations is how each actress interprets this. Is Gertrude now betraying Claudius's trust, or did she not believe Hamlet in the first place? Performance will be everything. In scene 2, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern play cat and mouse with Hamlet. It includes this exchange about Polonius's body.
"What have you done, my lord, with a dead body?"
"Combined it with dust where tutis kin.
Tell us what chase of him, I take it thence and bear it to the chapel."
"I do not believe it."
"Believe what?"
"That I can keep your counsel and not mine own. Besides, to be demanded of a sponge, what replication should be made by the son of a king?"
As Hamlet denies RNG's right to question him by reasons of class, he slips into prose, making it clear to them that he does not consider them worthy of verse.
"Taking me for a sponge, my lord."
"Aye, sir, that soaks up the king's countenance, his rewards, his authorities. But such officers do the king best service in the end. He keeps them like an ape, an apple, in the corner of his jaw, first mouthed to be last swallowed. When he needs what you have gleaned, it is but squeezing you, and sponge you shall be dry again."
A notable pun here is ape, which means apple, but can also be the primate. Hamlet simultaneously turns RNG into something to be slowly devoured, and the king into a brutish beast. As we'll see in scene 3, Hamlet will elaborate on the carnivorous metaphor in a way that informs this line as well, with additional insult. The point of the worm speech is an alchemical transformation, through words, of the king into baser matter. So if the king eats RNG in this particular image, he becomes like them, and in scene 3 will deserve the same kind of disrespect. More commutative speech. The body is with the king, but the king is not with the body. The king is a thing of nothing. It's a veiled threat. Hamlet considers Claudius already dead, part of his fatalism, though some may be expected to die sooner than others. So he is with the corpse spiritually, if not physically. Hamlet nihilistically turns Claudius into a thing, which is to say an object, and then into nothing at all, denying his existence, his right to the throne, and his life. Again, these are alchemical transformations, using words to denature a person and an office. Scene 3 has the confrontation between the king and Hamlet. In his opening speech, Claudius reveals that he can't have Hamlet executed. Because the prince is so loved, he fears a revolt from the common population of Denmark. This speaks to the political climate he's created by marrying Gertrude, interrupting the normal line of succession. When Laertes returns later, the rabble will be at the gates. Without their prince, the population is quick to object to the usurper king. Note how Hamlet shows disrespect by speaking in prose to the king.
Where's Polonius?
At supper.
At supper? Where?
Not where he eats, but where he is eaten. A certain convocation of politic worms are e'en at him. Your worm is your only emperor for diet. We fat all creatures else to fat us, and we fat ourselves for maggots, your fat king. And your lean beggar is but variable service. Two dishes but to one table. That's the end.
The alchemical transformations in this little speech loop around to undermine Claudius's right to rule. The worms are politic, a reference to Claudius's court, and Polonius in particular, bowing to him for political gain. The worm is an emperor, a title well above that of king, and the king is equal to the beggar on the worm's dining table. The former insultingly fat, the latter virtuously lean. The fatalistic image Hamlet creates here mocks everything Claudius stands for, but will be repurposed in the graveyard scene as a more sober acceptance of one's own death. The alchemical process reaches a crescendo as the king becomes a worm, then a fish, then food for a beggar. This equalizing metaphor not only threatens the king with death, which is its topic, but with revolution, the beggar devouring the king. Part of the disjointedness of the time element in the play is that it seems like Hamlet knows he's being shipped to England 3 scenes before he's actually exiled. We can resolve this with the text, as nothing contradicts the idea that Claudius is merely accelerating his plans in the wake of Polonius's murder, but it nevertheless creates that effect. On the subject of the trip to England, Hamlet says, "Good, and Claudius, so is it, if thou knewst our purposes." Claudius gives himself away here, and if Hamlet didn't know to watch himself on this voyage, he would now. One final alchemical transformation for the road, you might say.
But come, for England, farewell, dear mother.
My loving father, Hamlet.
Mother, father and mother is man and wife. Man and wife is one flesh. And so, my mother.
Hamlet transforms Claudius into the queen as a parting insult, or so Claudius receives it. Using the marriage vows as his metaphor, Hamlet changes his stepfather's gender, the weaker in this society, while also reminding him of his de facto coup d'etat. The real power is the queen, because Claudius is only allowed to rule through marriage with her, though it may also represent remnants of bitterness against his mother, tying her into Claudius's misdeeds once more. I prefer to think of it as a transference of the anger he felt towards her to Claudius alone. All the sins to be avenged are now in a single vessel. Finally, is there a satirical function to making England the instrument of Hamlet's death? Scholars better versed in history may be able to make that determination better than I. If England kills Hamlet, then it kills everything he represents? Should we infer an attack on the part of Shakespeare on English elements that would stifle intellectualism, poetry, a strong and vibrant theater, and other values that Hamlet espouses? After all, the scene wasn't just an attack on Claudius, but on royalty itself. Or perhaps I have it wrong, and because Claudius is a usurper, it's politicians that are being attacked, not nobility. How does England fit into that? I just don't feel equipped well enough to make a determination on Shakespeare's opinions on the matter, nor the historical context that might have prompted such an attack, if it is one. So, on to the adaptations. In the 1996 version, each of these 3 scenes is given its own unbroken shot, a technique that Branagh says fostered a kind of anxiety in the actors that translated to their characters. It's a clever and subtle way to get across the instability and political and personal upheaval caused by the prince effectively killing the prime minister. Scene 1. Most of Claudius's lines are played as an aside, even if Gertrude is present, usually off-screen. She's in shock, and obviously stunned, disconnected from the scene, and Branna renders that visually. Their final embrace is non-committal. Is she still clutching at him, wondering if she should betray him, or is he the one holding her close? And probably a bit of both. And in this version, he does love her, and she is the principal reason for the murder of Hamlet Sr., which clashes with his feelings for Hamlet, fear and murderous anger. And Hamlet is, nevertheless, Gertrude's reason for living. He's impatient with her contention that her son is somehow repentant, thinking her naive and foolish, because no matter how important Gertrude is to him, Claudius can't ignore his own selfishness. On hearing of Polonius's murder, he thinks first of his own safety, and by the time the scene is resolved, he's put together a plan to make sure the court knows who was really guilty of the crime, lest the blame fall on him. During a crisis, Claudius falls into public relations mode. Not content to believe Gertrude's interpretation, Claudius visits the crime scene himself, looks at the counterfeit presentment of two brothers on the bed, puts it all together. Between this scene and his next, scene 3, not to mention the play within the play, there's every reason to believe he's understood what Hamlet is really on about. The prince is gunning for him, possibly planning a coup, but at the very least trying to avenge his father's murder. He can no longer excuse the madness, nor does he particularly believe Hamlet's act. Meanwhile, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, asked to wait in the hall outside the rooms, are often in the frame, connecting them to Polonius, the other conspirator, listening in at a remove. Can their own deaths be far ahead? Then in scene 2, action. Soldiers running through Elsinore, searching Ophelia's bed. RNG find Hamlet first. He's creeping about as if in a comedy routine. They don't lay a finger on him, nor do the soldiers that join his train every time he turns a corner. It's a last hurrah for the madcap Hamlet, a version of the character that won't exist after scene 3. And as if in an encore of a previous scene, he even takes Rosencrantz hostage. Pipeless, this time. Bryna invents a bit where an awakened Ophelia comes down the stairs, comes face to face with him. And confronted by the woman he's just orphaned, the prince makes a run for it, going through room after room, jumping over tables. The courtiers seem to be having a late dinner after the play. And it's notable that he tries to avoid his fate, or perhaps he's just trying to find a weapon and get to Claudius before the guards get him. And in the end, he reaches his library slash study, but it's been compromised, as has the rest of Elsinore. Note how none of the guards are those shown loyal to him in Act 1. A rifle is leveled at his head, and we cut to Claudius. Scene 3. Claudius is in his own study, sealing letters bound for England and explaining, in a soliloquy, the politics behind his next action. I wonder if Derek Jacobi muddled the pronunciation of distracted multitude on purpose, because it sounds like destructive multitude to me.
He's loved of the destructive multitude.
Certainly, that's how he thinks of Denmark's population, as rabble. Not only stupid, the word here he uses is distract, but dangerous as well. He's interrupted by Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, who bring Hamlet to him. Horatio is also dragged in, either as a co-conspirator or to bear witness to Hamlet's fair treatment. There are two reasons to have him present, even if the text doesn't mention him. One is to keep him in play, the same way Ophelia has been brought into these scenes. Neither character has appeared since The Mousetrap, and neither gets a farewell scene with Hamlet before he's exiled. Branna manages to give each of them a wordless farewell, both given meaning through performance. The other reason to have him there is to cement his role as an objective witness in the final scene. If Horatio is telling us this story, he needs to be present as much as possible. Hamlet continues to be insolent, and Claudius has had enough. He's drinking more and more, it's one of his sins, and backhands Hamlet quite hard when the prince refuses to give him a straight answer. And yet, Hamlet doesn't break character or even lose his sense of humor. In fact, the scene becomes a kind of duel, both characters knowing the other's secrets, but daring the other to reveal themselves in front of witnesses. Hamlet even goes so far as to kiss Claudius on the mouth when he calls him his mother. Claudius finally breaks when Hamlet is carted off and he gives his "Do it, England" speech, barely containing the rage and anguish he feels at the discord in his heart.
By letters congruing to that effect, the present death of Hamlet! Do it, England! For like the hexagon, my bloody rage is, and thou must cure me. Then I noticed her. Howe'er, my haps, my joys were ne'er begun.
His wish is to kill his stepson, but politically, he needs to exile him instead. Either move, sure to hurt the woman he loves. Because the exile means death, there's also a measure of guilt there. This is a man who, only a few scenes ago, was suffering from having committed one murder, and here he is ordering another. It all plays out in Jacoby's voice. Before being taken away, Hamlet goes to Horatio and almost talks to him, leaving it at a silent look, passing between the two friends. Nothing so good for Ophelia, who is left clutching at the chapel's doors as her father's found body is brought in, screaming her head off, her sanity already slipping away. Those screams echo over the water in an exterior shot, extending the mad scream right to the site of the girl's death, the brook, where she will take her own life. Olivier cuts scenes 1, 2, and indeed 4 from Act 4, which does have a considerable impact on the play. By omitting scene 1, Claudius's character is impoverished. The king is rather flat throughout this adaptation. And we can't evaluate whether Gertrude sides with her son or her husband, though the previous act definitely leans towards the former. Scene 2's omission is unsurprising, given that Rosencrantz and Guildenstern have been excised from the play completely. So we start with scene 3, a much calmer moment for lacking the chase through Elsinore. In fact, the king is sealing letters with Hamlet standing right there. Claudius's tone is restrained, and ever the politician, he makes it sound like Hamlet's exile is for his own good, to avoid prosecution. The prince is insolent, but Claudius's lack of reaction turns the words into curious or profound observations rather than insult. Much more interesting is Hamlet's moment of madness when he calls Claudius his mother. He gets that faraway look in his eyes and his hands clench as if around someone's throat. By transforming his stepfather into his mother, or merging the two concepts, is he, in a way, giving Claudius a stay of execution? Olivier plays it as a realization.
Father and mother is man and wife. Man and wife is one flesh. And so... my mother...
It's as if, having decided not to harm his mother, he can now no longer harm her husband. Olivier is answering the question as to why Hamlet allows himself to go into exile rather than give in to his murderous impulse and kill the king instead. The exile saves all their lives, at least temporarily. Well, aside from Ophelia, of course. With scene 4 missing, this becomes the mid-play epiphany, the dramatic turning point. Not, my thoughts be bloody, quite the opposite. Hamlet apparently gives up his revenge and will have to wonder why he returns to Denmark later. He can't even kill his two false friends on the voyage to England since they don't exist. Does Claudius's treachery, the letters requesting his death, reignite his desires? Well, that's an analysis for another day. As for Claudius, the staging has him go to the window and give his closing speech, speaking to England across the sea, a cool, collected delivery that speaks less to rage than it does to acceptance of one's situation.
If my love thou holdst at aught, thou mayst not coldly treat our sovereign order, which imports at full the present death of Hamlet. Do it, England.
The role is underplayed here, but one might still praise it as an ideal form of Hamlet himself, a character who has already come to terms with the readiness is all. In the BBC version, aired in 1980, watch how masterful a politician Patrick Stewart's first take as Claudius is. In scene 1, he's obviously angry at his wife and wants her to stop crying long enough to get the answers he needs from her, and he's visibly shaken when he investigates the site of Polonius's death and gets blood on his hands. This relates to his previous scene. It reminds him of his own murder. Indeed, we're reminded here that Polonius's death is ultimately his fault as well, since the old man wouldn't be skulking around Elsinore if he hadn't tasked him to. Nor would Hamlet be so dangerous had his father not been killed. There's a dramatic reason why Hamlet Sr. was specifically poisoned. It's a poison that courses through their entire family tree and the whole of Denmark. A murder that spreads. He wipes the blood off in a panic, as if trying to hide his own sins from the world, which is exactly what he will do politically. He's seen his way out of the situation, and it's as a politician that he next addresses Gertrude. He'll exile Hamlet in such a way that even his mother can't argue. He makes a case that they're both in this together. No one is safe. And further, that she shares in the blame for loving Hamlet too much and letting the situation get out of hand. She tries to argue Hamlet's case, but it won't work this time. Claudius is on more solid ground, but when he tells her to come away with him, she stays behind, the staging telling us their relationship has been split asunder. Scene 2, catching up to Hamlet. We find him safely stowed and not running, speaking to camera as he does in the dark, waiting to be discovered. When he is, by Rosencrantz and Guildenstern's posse, he still doesn't run, but rather continues to undermine their authority over him as he did in the previous act. However, Rosencrantz is done playing games, and sensing that he and his partner now have the king's favor over Hamlet, becomes very cold towards his former friend. He refuses to acknowledge any meaning in Hamlet's words. Derek Jacobi, as usual, puts enough of a spin on each and every line that I can't possibly take RNG's lead on this. He makes me want to find meaning in his mad dialogue, and new meaning at that. For example, I'm now trying to read "the body is with the king, but the king is not with the body," with the king relating to Hamlet Sr. rather than Claudius.
The body is with the king, but the king is not with the body.
Certainly, the ghost could be a thing of nothing, but I still get lost in the verbal alchemy. The text has Claudius attended in the third scene, but it's often staged with him starting on his speech alone. What difference it makes when he's actually giving orders to courtiers. Here we have a politician once again, explaining the situation, his plan, and most crucially, that we're all in this together. By implying that the peasants love Hamlet, he says rebellion will be the likely result if they don't agree with his plan, making them all accomplices. Hamlet comes in, sits on the desk, inspects the sealed letters casually, and everything in the staging shows that power shifting in Elsinore. Hamlet is sitting higher than the king. Is far less anxious, so does Claudius fear the prince will expose him in front of everyone? And having now killed, he's at least on Claudius's level. The king must retake control of the situation, and does, standing, first of all, and once again playing the politician's part. The way he tells Hamlet of his exile, it's like he's helping him escape a worse fate. Again, it's a case of being in this together, and this time as a family. It doesn't really work on Hamlet, but there are other people in the room. Hamlet actually leads them out, as if the trip was his idea, pointing at the attendants to fire them into action. We're left believing Hamlet won the scene. He leaves head held high, while Claudius, with tired sighs, asks England to do his dirty work for him. Now on to Zeffirelli's version. Before Claudius comes shouting in, Gertrude has a moment alone to herself, looking at the effigy of her late husband. She quickly hides it from the newer, more murderous model, but by this, we know she's chosen a side. After this sequence, Zeffirelli restores the last few lines from Act 3 to give Hamlet and Gertrude a proper farewell, fixing, if you like, the anomaly of Hamlet knowing about his exile before he's actually told to go by the king.
I must to England, you know that.
Yes.
There's letters sealed.
And that's fine. Give or take an inappropriate kiss, and it makes it even more clear that the queen is her son's accomplice. In the play as written, she has no contact with him after he's caught and sent away, letting ambiguity reign regarding her true feelings. In this restructuring of the play, she gives him hopeful smiles as he reassures her that he will keep a close eye on Rosencrantz and Guildenstern. Claudius, for his part, suffers some cuts in the breakneck pace Zeffirelli has adopted. In scene 1, his "it had been so with us had we been there" serves as a punchline, cutting from bloodstains on the floor to his office, when he arrives in a hurry to give the order to apprehend Hamlet. We might wonder why he wasn't attended in the first part of the scene to avoid the location change, but it does create a more urgent rhythm as Elsinore wakes up and attempts to find the prince and his victim. In fact, scene 2 is reduced to a single shot of Rosencrantz and Guildenstern and some guards with torches shouting out Hamlet's name. Scene 3 is, as usual, fully rendered, though Claudius still suffers an interruption when his political speech to his courtiers is shortened by RNG's arrival. By cutting the line of dialogue about Hamlet being kept outside, the director achieves two things. First, he makes the action run faster by removing the planned delay. Second, by having Rosencrantz shake his head when asked where is he, and giving Hamlet an entrance from the other side of the room, he stages it so the prince is there willingly and was never caught. He whistles rudely, he jumps on the table, kicks at some candles, mockingly wears Polonius's hat. This is a brazen attack on Claudius's authority, and Hamlet brings the fight to him. It's a war of words, with both men making veiled but plain threats. But it's presumably all Hamlet can afford while surrounded by Claudius's men. Still, the danger to the king seems more palpable because Hamlet was never caught. He got all the way to Claudius's inner sanctum. Okay, Hamlet 2000. That one skips right to scene 2, where Rosencrantz and Guildenstern find Hamlet washing his bloody clothes in a laundromat. Cutting scene 1 is easily done, since the audience can infer that the murder was found out and people were sent to track the killer. We're only really missing Claudius's selfish reaction to it. In this modern adaptation, the whole sequence, as Claudius walks in with bodyguards soon after being called by one of the twins, smacks of something out of a gangster movie. The family never called the police. They're handling this themselves, quite possibly falsifying the details of Polonius's death to protect Hamlet from the authorities. And for that, they need the body. The laundromat is obviously redolent in meaning, a place where Hamlet attempts to wash his soul of his sin, and where indeed we learn the king washed it from the public eye. We found out it was Halloween earlier. A child dressed as a ghost booed at the king. So there are two pumpkins on a table in the corner. And in an amusing piece of staging, Rosencrantz sits next to them during the scene. So that's a visual attack on his wits, or both their wits. Unlike most interpretations, they let Claudius win the scene. He comes in with a disarming smile, and Hamlet gets through his lines with fear and apprehension in his voice. The prince even tries to bolt for the door, but he's pinned to the wall by the king's bodyguards. Claudius vacillates between kindness and thuggery, punching Hamlet in the gut when he loses patience with him, but tenderly wiping the hair off his brow when he finally gives up the body's location. Among the many cuts is Hamlet's seeing a cherub that sees Claudius's purposes. So only in the final disquieting kiss to his mother/father does Hamlet score a point. The look on the bodyguard's face says it all. These people are crazy. Cut to the airport, where Hamlet is given a rare farewell with a very drunk Gertrude. Cold at first, then coming back for a warm embrace, an image of their last conversation in a way. Claudius stays in the limo to do his short soliloquy, and he has to get it out fast before Gertrude returns to the car. He's in his own world when she does, and he doesn't notice the way she looks at him, now mistrusting and wary. So, though scene 1 was cut, we still get a very good idea of which side she's really on thanks to her inclusion in scene 3. Fodor's Hamlet makes Ophelia much more of a participant in this sequence, starting on her and a visitation from a Hamlet ghost child. She follows him out into the hall, where a young Ophelia ghost is also running around. In this world, it seems your spirit can leave you early and remain in echoes of better times. Ophelia ignores her younger self and moves towards the end of the hall, while unintelligible shouts are heard resonating through Elsinore, likely people looking for Hamlet. Ophelia finds him first. He's just stowed the body behind a folding screen in a room dimly lit in red. From one of the doors, she spies Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, who find Hamlet. These are much more menacing and violent characters in Fodor's adaptation, so Rosencrantz is visibly holding back from attacking the prince, and with great difficulty, it seems. Guildenstern's "A thing, my lord?" is said with outrage, instead of the usual misunderstanding tone.
A thing, my lord!
Calling the king a thing is, it seems, a step too far, and the sponges wonder how much trouble Hamlet is willing to get himself into. After they leave, Ophelia walks towards the folding screen, where she finds her sister Polonia's body hung in the closet, head down. She tries to take her down to awaken her, and failing, throws an expletive-filled tantrum. Flashback images remind us of Polonia's role as her sister's drug pusher, sticking needles into her arm to manipulate her. The whole setup creates an entirely new motivation for Ophelia's madness. She hasn't lost a beloved father at her lover's hand. She's lost her dealer. She's angry, not distraught. But soon she'll be feeling the pangs of withdrawal. What's more interesting is that Polonia has basically been placed behind an heiress, in death an image of the life she led. Scene 3 is entirely omitted, as is scene 1. It's an odd exclusion, as we may wonder where Hamlet is gone. The point is made later when he returns, so expediency may have been the order of the day. And since Ophelia discovers Polonia's body, there's less of a reason for Claudius to keep asking where it is. The Tenant Hamlet, scene 1. Patrick Stewart's Claudius is as ambiguous a figure as he is creepy in this sequence. Gertrude is startled out of her sobs by hands around her neck, a killer's hands, though it's of course meant to be a massage. Because we're experiencing the scene through her, the camera focuses on showing us her reactions. Everything Claudius says and does is imbued with a threatening quality, even though, on the surface, he shows her nothing but kindness. But is he asking her questions out of concern for her well-being, or sounding her to see if Hamlet revealed his murderous secret? She's very careful not to give too much away, weighs every word, and scrutinizes his face, looking for a sign that he might do her or her son harm. Claudius, too, weighs his words, but as a slick politician does, making cool choices to control others' perceptions of him. Though she's shocked at his assertion that his love for her, for her son, was too strong to stop this from happening, he eventually wins her over when he admits his soul is full of dismay. She reacts to his pain and finally finds the man she loves and was evidently seeking for. We cut away before the embrace, though the director says they did indeed kiss at this moment when the scene was shot, and perhaps presumably in the stage version. Gertrude may be desperate to cling to what she once had and resolve her mixed feelings, but there's no denying Claudius' selfish streak here. Yes, his first reaction to Polonius' death is shock that he might have been the target of the assassination, but beyond that, there's a moment when he calls Rosencrantz and Guildenstern into the room, thoughtlessly exposing Gertrude to humiliation. She's in her nightgown and has been crying and looks quite vulnerable. As RNG walk in, she goes running with a yelp and sits her back to them. She's mortified. And at no point does Claudius even notice. He's playing the part he wrote for himself, that of the concerned father, tiredly apologetic when asking Hamlet's two school chums to go and find the prince and the corpse. There's definitely a vein of black comedy in the matter-of-fact way it's played.
Oh, friends both. Go join you with some further aid. Hamlet in madness hath Polonius slain. And from his mother's closet hath he dragged him. Go seek him out. Speak fair and bring the body into the chapel. Pray you make haste.
And then in scene two, the comedy explodes with the apprehensive, not to say terrified, duo and a host of guards running around corridors and staircases a la Marx Brothers through Elsinore in search of the killer prince. The music is humorous and stops when they stop so they can hear the body being dragged downstairs. It's darkly funny. The Hamlet they find is Mad Hamlet, waiting for them in complete control and soon doing voices, pitching up on the squeeze, for example, or giving the next few lines a swinging cadence as his body sways around a post, appropriately ape-like.
The body is with the king, but the king is not with the body. The king is a thing of nothing.
The scene is lit by torches, or as we say in North America, flashlights, giving it an uneasy feeling, through which we will understand RNG's reaction. Hamlet is having fun, but no one thinks it's funny. Not getting a reaction, he gives up and asks to be brought to the king, at which point he resumes running, jumping the balustrade, and leading them on a merry chase once again. Scene 3. At the bottom of a stairwell, a new venue, an ugly basement with mysterious stains on the concrete floor and a broken mirror over the dirty wash basin. A place where things are done in secret. Torture? Covert murder? People made to disappear. The cool and collected, even reasonable Claudius is attended by lawyer types in suits, one of which will turn out to be a doctor. Again, we have the push and pull of a reasoned leader protecting his family, who could also be about to kill Hamlet and have his body wash up somewhere innocuous, at least for the audience who doesn't know the play. Enter Hamlet, taped to a chair on casters, a piece of tape on his mouth as well. It's an interrogation slash torture scene. The threat to his life doesn't deter Hamlet from his mockeries. He makes his wild speeches and responds to Claudius's cracking on,
"Where is Polonius?"
with a silly shouting voice. The doctor in the room shoots him up with some drug, precursor to his exile, a way to smuggle him, sedate, out of the country. There's a nice moment when Hamlet looks straight into the camera at his mention of a cherub that sees Claudius' purposes, something that can easily be translated to the stage. The audience sees all. And it's true to say that soliloquies are a kind of compact between character and audience. It admits our existence in the world of the play, as observers and judges. In the film, we're part of the paranoid hyper-surveillance theme, but our function is the same. And whee! Hamlet is rolled out of the room, eager to get to England now that he's done with Claudius, acting the child to the end. Claudius's brief soliloquy is told in The Broken Mirror, a match to the one upstairs in Gertrude's closet, and a reference to the mirror used in the stage production. This is an Elsinore that is falling apart, disjointed and fractured, just like its royal family unit, like Ophelia's mind. And that's where Doran's Hamlet will go next, placing scene 5 before scene 4. Now, the original Classics Illustrated, with no space to spare after that giant ghost visitation double-page splash. This three-scene sequence is reduced to a single panel, with a caption box explaining what happens, and Claudius, finally alone, revealing his true agenda, the execution of Hamlet at England's hands. The original Classics Illustrated was nothing if not precipitous when it came to talking scenes. The single panel is more or less used as a punchline, a surprise twist that Hamlet has been sent to his death. In three panels, going from a claustrophobic close-up to an airy wide shot, perhaps representing how Claudius feels trapped by the situation and freed by his decision, the Berkeley version's Hamlet also reduces the sequence to a single moment. Once again, Hamlet has been caught off-screen, and no final confrontation between prince and king is to be had on the page. You know, thrift, thrift, Horatio. Strangely, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are allowed to stand there while Claudius pronounces his usually secret soliloquy. This makes them more obviously complicit in Hamlet's murder. They know the contents of the letters they carry and perhaps better deserve their deaths. Of course, part of this is the freeze frame aspect of the comic's form. A panel's actions represent a single second, but the dialogue takes far longer. Might RNG have left in between two speech bubbles and thus never heard the king's more private words? It's an ambiguity that wouldn't exist on the stage or on film. Strangely out of place on disc one of the Johnny Hallyday double album, between Ophélie aux Folies, Ophelia aux Madness, and Jolie, I Read, is a song about the transmigration of kings through the guts of beggars. Its position seems to relate far more to Hamlet Sr. than it does Claudius, which isn't inappropriate, and resonates with the fishmonger and carrion references in the play as they relate to the song I Read, which is to say Hamlet's confrontation with Polonius. In any case, I held off discussing it until we reached the proper speech in the play. The tune itself is unremarkable, though as usual, Halliday has gone beyond Shakespeare's particular metaphors and introduced his own images. L'astico roi, the worm king, uses a number of eating-related words in some figurative sense, not all of which are easily translatable. For example, the word croquant, which means yokel in this context, literally means crunchy or biting. The lyrics take the concept of a beggar eating the fish that ate the worm that fed of the king's rotting corpse and widens it. Halliday links it to Denmark and Tyre by having carrion enrich the soil that feeds the country and then the next king. He also creates the image of a kingly lion devouring its neighbor with its queen, unknowingly eating of its own kind. And with the image of the king's cooks going hungry while he chokes on food, we're presented with the king as parasite. Is this part of the original image? Not entirely. Though the very idea of a nobleman, like Hamlet, even mentioning his country's poor is a subtle indictment of the king's rule, a dramatic representation of the gap between Denmark's classes, a failure of leadership. Finally, in the song, we have the king choking on king, restoring the veiled threat that Hamlet makes. Claudius will die because he committed regicide. And that ends our look at Act 4, scenes 1 through 3. Next time, we move right along to scene 4 and Hamlet's encounter with Fortinbras's army. In the meantime, if you have thoughts on this particular episode, please head over to fireandwaterpodcast.com and leave them there. And if you like this content, think about visiting our Patreon page at patreon.com/fwpodcasts. Thanks for listening, and I hope you, dear listener, will return for Act 4, Scene 4.
The rest is silent.